Thank you, everybody. This is Larry Thompson. Thank you for joining us for this announcement by Francis Collins. A press release related to this announcement was posted to the website of the National Human Genome Research Institute, genome.gov, at 3 p.m. Just a few seconds ago it went up, just as we were starting this. So we will have opening remarks by Dr. Collins, and then by Dr. Alan Guttmacher, a physician and geneticist who serves as deputy director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. And then we will be taking your questions, which I will moderate. Dr. Collins.
Thank you, Larry, and good afternoon to all of you. I'm announcing today that I intend to step down as director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, effective August 1st, 2008. I want to make it clear that I'm not actually leaving to take any particular job. I'm leaving because the time seems right to explore a number of professional opportunities, some in the public, some in the private sectors, that would be very difficult to consider or discuss or pursue while continuing in my role as a federal employee. I want very much not to do anything in my role here as director of the NHGRI that would in any way put me in a conflict of interest in many of the potential roles that I might ultimately hope to explore. Would have that character. And so instead of trying to get around those issues in a way that might be quite awkward and ineffective, I've decided to step down August 1st and basically to take a kind of sabbatical. What will I be doing? Well, I have some writing projects in mind that I would like to pursue, especially about the future of personalized medicine, an area that I think shows great promise, but about which there is currently quite a bit of confusion, and where I think some material for the public might actually be quite beneficial at this time that explains what we know and what we don't know. But also to reflect and to spend some time after 15 years in this position to try to identify my next opportunity for service. I'm not being coy with you. I do not have a definite plan of what that next step will be, and I expect it will take some months to do that kind of exploration and see where I could be most useful. Let me make it clear, I'm not leaving because of any problems or disagreements with NIH leadership. I've been very fortunate to be here during a 15-year period of wonderful scientific advance and to work with many colleagues who are just remarkable scientists and remarkable human beings. Certainly the budgetary constraints on NIH over the last 5 years have been deeply troublesome for those of us trying to encourage research forward here, and that is certainly something that I hope can be redressed in the future. But that is not the reason I am leaving. NIH continues to move forward, and the Genome Institute continues to conduct incredible research, not as much perhaps as the opportunities could allow, but we are certainly seeing great advances that I've had the chance to watch and preside over in the last few years, many of them coming on the heels of the success of the Genome Project. I was actually reluctant to come here in 1993, leaving at that time a position at Michigan that I was very fond of. I'm not one of those people that easily seems to jump from position to position. But as I reflect about the last 15 years, the decision to come here was a wonderful one, and my time at NHGRI has been the most remarkable in my life. I've had the benefit of wonderful colleagues, a wonderful leadership here, wonderful scientists around the world to work with in a variety of international collaborations, and scientific questions that used to be just hypothetical, which are now being answered right and left by the advances in the genome technology and application field. We've seen really astonishing discoveries during these 15 years. The success of the Human Genome Project in 2003, completing all the goals that had been set 13 years earlier, and that really laid the foundation for a fundamental shift in medical care that we now call personalized medicine, which is very much a couple of words on everybody's lips, but showing great promise for the future. Since 2003, I've had the opportunity to initiate and lead a host of bold follow-up projects that are rapidly moving genomics into the mainstream of medicine. The HapMap project, the ENCODE project, a project to knock out all the mouse genes, roadmap projects focused on the effort to try to develop technologies for small molecule research in academia or to study the human microbiome, the study of cancer using the Cancer Genome Atlas, and a long list of others, any single one of which would be an exhilarating opportunity. And putting them all together, it's been a marvelous ride. I've also had the wonderful opportunity to found an intramural program in genomics on the NIH campus, which is was able to recruit an outstanding cadre of scientists and physicians and has emerged, in my view, as one of the strongest bench-to-bedside groups of researchers in genetics and genomics in the entire world. And I've had the privilege of working with the entire research community, the policy community, disease advocates, and leaders in the Congress and the administration to address proactively the many most important social, ethical, and legal issues that arise out of genome research. The effort to focus on those issues has characterized the Genome Project from the beginning, has been a new experiment in bringing together science and its social consequences, and a particularly visible example of the importance of this and the success of this effort was seeing the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act become law last week. So deciding to leave now has been a terribly difficult decision, and I've been wrestling with this for many months, because it is a very exciting time. Genomic science is revolutionizing medical research, and great progress is being made. Look at all the deluge of discoveries about genetic factors in common disease that have been pouring out of research labs in the last couple of years, building on the shoulders of the Human Genome Project, the HapMap Project, and the technologies that have made this kind of comprehensive search of the genome possible in ways we could barely have dreamed of 10 years ago. But I'm convinced that the National Human Genome Research Institute is in very strong shape and will continue to remain at the forefront of this revolution in genomics. My leaving will not derail that progress in any way. I leave behind a fabulous team of motivated, risk-taking, creative scientists who will continue to oversee the work in which we've invested so much and continue to make bold investments in research that may be high risk but will certainly be high payoff for that part that succeeds, and I think our track record would say we've done pretty well in that regard, and we'll continue to. There are so many colleagues at NIH that I would want to thank for their support over the years, but if I started down that road, I would most certainly forget someone, and generally such a list wouldn't be very useful to you on the phone in your stories anyway, so I'm going to spare you that. But there is one person I would like to thank, and that's Dr. Alan Guttmacher, long my friend and colleague, who will take over as acting director of the Genome Institute on August 1st. Alan is a physician, a geneticist. He has been the most able deputy director of the National Human Genome Research Institute for the last 6 years. And so I will leave the institute in very good hands under his leadership until a permanent director is selected, which will be a search process that will get underway under Dr. Zerhouni's direction in the near future. So I'd now like to turn the phone over to Dr. Guttmacher and suggest that he might say a few words to you about his perspective and his plans. Alan?
Thank you, Francis, and good afternoon to all of you. Like the rest of NHGRI staff, I'm sad to see Francis leave. Working so closely with him over the past 9 years has been rewarding for the remarkable scientific progress we have helped facilitate, and also has been a profound personal pleasure. One could not ask for a better colleague or leader. It will be challenging to work without Francis' wise guidance. In addition to being a visionary leader, he's been an expert organizer of collaborations and, as you all know particularly well, a great communicator of science. However, Francis leaves us in a wonderful situation since he's attracted such a superb staff to the Institute. NHGRI is run by a highly skilled team of scientists, including Mark Geyer, who directs the Institute's extramural program that funds genomic research across the country and across the globe, and Eric Green, our scientific director, who runs the intramural team of scientists who conduct genetic and genomic research here at the NIH. And we are blessed in genomics with unparalleled scientific opportunities and an outstanding community of researchers. We face a truly historic opportunity to understand the intricacies of our shared human genome and how it functions, and to use that understanding to determine how the genome and environmental factors interact to cause health and disease. Together, NHGRI and its collaborators, both at the NIH and in the extramural community, will continue full speed ahead with our efforts to understand the human genome and to bring the promise of genomic science to medicine in a way that can make healthcare truly personalized and preemptive. Francis is a great friend, and I will miss working with him every day. But I am supremely confident that he will find new ways to enrich the lives of people around the globe, and I look forward to continuing the proud legacy that he has created here at NHGRI. Larry?
Thank you, Alan. So I would like to remind all of you that you can ask a question by pressing the star key and 1 on your touch tone phone to get into the question queue, and you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. So let me start by, calling you guys out in order, basically, and the operator will patch you in. Bob Grant from The Scientist is already in the queue. So Bob, why don't you go ahead and ask your first question?
Yes, Dr. Collins. You said that you've been sort of grappling with this decision for many months now. Did the signing into law of GINA last week sort of spur you into action here?
In a way, it did. This has been a 13-year effort to try to see this legislation make it through all of the hoops and become law. And when it became clear in late April that the logjam that had kept the bill tied in knots for a year in the Senate had broken, and that was going to come through and be signed by the president, that did seem to be a very significant milestone. And having that happen had been one of my personal goals while I was here at NHGRI. So yes, I will be honest, that did have a significant effect on the timing decision.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you very much, Bob. So let's go to Erica Check Hayden from Nature Magazine. Erica?
Hi, I was wondering, Dr. Collins, you've obviously written a book and done a lot of work in the arena of science and religion, and I was curious whether you're pursuing or interested in opportunities in that direction, say at foundations or things like this.
Thanks, Erica. Again, I think my horizons are pretty open here in terms of the potential next steps. Certainly this is an area that I'm interested in, the interface between science and faith, and I would hope to continue to be engaged in those conversations. But I don't know that would end up being my full-time activity. I'm not sure I really have the credentials to make the kind of contribution in that area that others might. My focus, my expertise is in science, and I expect that's where I will land. It's just not clear to me what kind of science or in what location. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay. Anything else, Erica?
I'll let others ask.
Okay. Thank you very much. You can always get back in the queue. Let's go to Rick Weiss from the Washington Post.
Hi, thanks, Dr. Collins. Can you tell us whether you've had any even preliminary discussions with people inside any of the current campaigns for president?
Thanks for the question, Rick. No, again, as I've been in this role as an institute director at NIH, and because of things like the Hatch Act, while it's possible to have some conversations in a fashion that are consistent with being a federal employee, it is so constraining that outside of some very informal and very nonspecific chatter, I really have not gotten engaged in any meaningful way. Obviously, this is an interesting year, and as someone who will expect after August 1st to be somewhat less constrained, who knows? It might be fun to be engaged in some of those conversations. Goodness knows, the world in its future has a lot of issues for which science is going to be an important part of the solution. And if there's some way that I can help in that regard, of course I'd be interested in doing so. But that's all rather vague, not because I'm trying to obscure anything, but just because it is at the moment vague in reality.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go on to another question. This one's from Steve Sternberg at USA Today. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Collins. Congratulations on taking this next step. Do you see yourself back in bench science at all?
Hi, Steve. Thanks for the question. Yeah, actually, being involved in bench science has been an important and rewarding part of my career all the way along. I've kept a lab going at NIH that has done in the last few years some really interesting stuff on diabetes, where we've made a number of discoveries of genes involved in disease risk, and also this dramatic disease of premature aging called progeria, where my lab discovered the genetic glitch and have been following up on that even now to the point of being part of a clinical trial for kids with this disease. I would like not to give that up, although obviously that is a challenge in a circumstance where I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I will be continuing to act as a special volunteer at NIH, which is to say an unpaid volunteer who can still come into the lab and play some role in continuing the mentoring of the students and postdocs that I'm responsible for, so that they don't have their careers upset by this particular decision on my part. And I'm looking forward to that, and I would expect during these months of my time working on the book and thinking about possibilities, that I will have a chance to continue to rub shoulders with my lab group pretty much as I have been doing for the last year or two. They will be reassigned officially to another investigator because as a volunteer, I'm not in a position to be able to oversee their work in an official way. Dr. Larry Brody, who is a tenured investigator at the Genome Institute, has agreed to take on that oversight responsibility. And his lab and my lab have shared space for a number of years, and my folks know him and he knows them, and I think this is a good solution.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone.
Okay, and let's go to a follow-up question from Rick Weiss at the Washington Post.
Hi, thanks. With regard to the book, can you tell us a little more about the book, whether you have a publisher at this point and what your approach is going to be on personalized medicine? Are you talking about sort of direct-to-consumer genetic tests? Are you talking more medically the personalized medicine revolution through research?
All of the above, Rick, and certainly you've written about this topic very effectively, as have other people on the phone, and I think we would all agree that this is an area of great promise, great earthquakes of events here, particularly with direct-to-consumer marketing coming along, and I think there is an opportunity to try to explain that, and so in a book of this sort, I would try to lay out all of those issues in a fashion that is accessible to people who don't have PhDs in genetics. And the science is a little complicated, but I think it is susceptible to that kind of explanation in a user-friendly way. I don't have a publisher. It would actually not be possible for me to enter into any contract with a publisher while I'm still a federal employee, so that will all have to wait for August. But by having this conversation with you, I'm not trying to negotiate with anybody. So this remains to be worked out after I step down.
Well, didn't you have a didn't you manage your last book through a contract with a publisher while you were an NIH employee?
I did, and that was approved at the highest levels after much review because it was a topic that was considered really quite separate from my official duties. So that book called The Language of God was about the science-faith interaction. Whereas personalized medicine is much closer to what I do as the Genome Institute director, and so it really would not be appropriate to enter into a contract for that book while I'm still employed here.
Got it.
Okay, great. Let's go on to a question from Lauren Neargarden at the at the Associated Press. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi, Dr. Collins, and I guess congratulations is the appropriate word here for you. Can I ask you if you've had any conversations with private industry, and if so, what lingering federal rules you would have to follow?
So thanks, Lauren, for your congratulations and for your question. No, I have not. That, of course, is a circumstance where immediately one runs into potential difficulties as far as the current rules for conflicts of interest. So I've had no conversations with people in the private sector. I'm an admirer of what the private sector has accomplished and will accomplish, and obviously the role of genomics in the private sector in terms of biotech and pharmaceutical industry is growing more and more all the time. But until August 1st, I won't be in a position to make any real explorations of that, those possibilities.
Thank you.
Public service. Okay. All right, let's go to Murray Jacobson at NewsHour.
Hi, Dr. Collins. We'd like to send you congratulations as well. I was wondering if you have started to give thought, I realize this is quick now that Gina has just been approved and signed into law, but as you're looking out onto the horizon and looking at things like personalized medicine, if you've identified what you think is the next area of either regulation, legislation related to all this that you think needs to be worked on?
Hi, Murray. Thanks for that question, too, because, yeah, we have been thinking a lot about that. I think there has been so much focus on trying to get GINA passed, because that was clearly the highest priority, that one might have thought that was the only priority, but you could say that was the end of the beginning. And now we really do need to turn attention to some of these other issues, about which a lot of scholarship has been devoted, thanks to our ELSI research program. But where the policy deliberations have not yet come to fruition. Certainly regulation is one of those issues, and people differ in their views on this, but I would point you to a recent set of recommendations from the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Genomics, Health, and Society, a group that I sit on as the NIH liaison, that came out just a couple of months ago with a recommendation that there really ought to be more oversight of genetic testing, particularly when it is direct to consumer, because otherwise there is a potential there for misinformation to be marketed to people who are then misled by the opportunities presented to them. One of the things recommended by that group, which I strongly support, is the need for a public database of information about genetic tests in a user-friendly format, so that if you're contemplating buying one of these direct-to-consumer tests, you'd have a real clear sense about what the information is and what it isn't. What's the clinical validity, in other words, of the kinds of things that one can now do, particularly in terms of genetics of common disease. There are also other issues about access. Who's going to have the ability to take advantage of these kinds of technologies as they come forward? And of course, that's a general question about healthcare in this country. And there are issues about discrimination that go beyond health insurance and the workplace, which is what Gina covered, into such questions as life insurance, disability, long-term care, all areas that are actually somewhat more complicated because of the risk of adverse selection really damaging the economies of those sectors, but also circumstances where some progress could be made in terms of trying to balance those issues of the economy with fairness and justice to individuals, recognizing that there are no perfect genetic specimens, and we ought to be careful not to get ourselves into a place that we later regret.
Do you see, is there a particular area in one of the many that you mentioned there where you're starting to see things already percolating on the legislative or regulatory front?
Perhaps in the regulatory front, not legislatively, but certainly this long discussion that's actually been going on for more than 10 years about whether there ought to be more oversight of genetic tests does seem to be escalating in its intensity. Obviously, it's anybody's guess exactly what will result in terms of actions being taken, but I think there's a lot more attention to this issue than there has been in some time, and I'm certainly hopeful that will lead to some beneficial actions to give the public an opportunity to know exactly what they're getting into if they're contemplating a genetic test.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, let's move on to Jocelyn Kaiser at Science Magazine. Jocelyn?
Hi, Dr. Collins. I wondered, you say you're thinking about potentially positions in the public or private sector. I wondered if you are inclined to go towards the nonprofit sector, or, you know, if you have any inclination versus a company, and also whether you could see yourself in a federal position again.
Thanks, Jocelyn. I've never been somebody who's paid particular attention to the size of income. I guess that's why I've stayed in the government for a long time. So I'm not likely to be driven by those issues. I would like to find a place where I can make some contribution to the public good. And certainly the nonprofit sector does a great deal of that. And that would be a likely place to look. So does the government. And obviously many places in the government that make those contributions where science is important and I might be able to be helpful. But at the present time, I hope nobody gets the sense that I'm holding out on you. I really have not had the chance to do the kind of survey of the landscape that anybody ought to do before they make a step of this sort. I'm 58 years old. I think I may have another career in me. I just don't know what it is. I would want it to be something where when I wake up in the morning, I have a sense that I'm doing something useful that's helping somebody in a significant way, but I don't know what that will turn out to be as far as the best fit.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, let's go to Erica Check Hayden again at Nature.
Hi, Dr. Collins. I have two questions to follow up with. So one is that you're now, you know, one of the directors that's been at NIH the longest, and I'm curious to know, you know, how the agency has changed over the time that you've been there. And the second is, you know, as you know very, very well, that the ELSI program has existed, you know, hand in hand with the Genome Project as long as it has been in existence. So why has it seemed that, you know, over the past year or so, with this proliferation of direct-to-consumer tests and personal genomics companies, at times it has seemed like, you know, we're a bit caught out as far as dealing with sort of the implications of these technologies?
So first question, how has NIH changed? Well, quite a lot over 15 years, as you can imagine, both scientifically and in terms of the personalities and the leadership but actually in a wonderfully exciting way. And certainly as the genome revolution got underway and the Genome Project began to empower so many areas of science, it's been wonderful for me to see how that has spread throughout the entire NIH, with every institute now seeing genomics as a central part of what they do. That's the best possible indication of the value of what's been accomplished. I will tell you that those 5 years when NIH was undergoing a doubling were particularly wonderful to be part of, because we could move faster on things where we knew what to do, and we finally had the resources to be able to push that forward at a really dramatic pace. And I will tell you that for the last 5 years, with NIH having flat budgets, in fact eroded by inflation, actually the buying power falling year after year, it has been much tougher for me as an institute director to preside over our grants program and to have to tell investigators who have good ideas that their ideas just didn't quite make a very difficult pay line and we can't find the funds for them. And I certainly hope the time will come before too long where that situation can start to improve, because it has really put a cloud over what otherwise scientifically has been an amazingly exciting time. The ELSI question you ask. If you look at our ELSI research program, you will certainly see a whole lot of scholarship going back more than a decade about the ways in which genetic testing might begin to emerge more and more into the mainstream. And there are some useful predictions and lessons to be had there. But in a certain way, it was the success of the HapMap-based genome-wide association studies that came so fast onto the scene that has really now resulted in a very different kind of landscape, with the direct-to-consumer marketing for common diseases going from a discovery published in a paper to something being marketed to people over the web in a matter sometimes of days. And I don't think, for the most part, people were anticipating that this approach to one of the most difficult problems in human genetics, namely things like diabetes and cancer and heart disease, was actually going to work so well and so quickly. And I don't think that's the ELSI program's fault. In a certain way, we were all, I guess, maybe a little less bold in our predictions than we might have been. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a great deal left to learn about the genetics of those conditions, a lot of the heritability yet to be discovered, the advent of rapid sequencing techniques to take us to the next level, where you don't just look at known variations, but you look at the entire genome of large numbers of people, is right around the corner. These revelations will continue to happen, and we need to continue to have our ELSI program and the policies that go with it move at just as rapid a pace. And that will always be a challenge, because I think the science is more likely, based on past experience, to rocket forward at an exponential pace. And the ethical, legal, and social issues, and particularly the policy handoff, is much more difficult to orchestrate. But we have to make our absolutely most intense efforts to have that happen.
Okay. Is that okay, Erica? Erica? All right. Let's move on to Rick Weiss at the Washington Post.
Hey, thanks. One last quick question. With regard to the Secretary's Advisory Committee and the recommendations you folks forwarded, some of us have been wondering, because at least on the public side here, there has been no response from Secretary Leavitt. Can you tell us whether you have had, or anyone on the committee has had, any kind of response other than a perhaps perfunctory thank you to those recommendations?
I am not aware of a response, Rick, and I guess I'm not too surprised. Oftentimes, it's a big, thick report, and I don't remember the precise date when it was sent over, but it hasn't been very long. So I suspect the Secretary is considering this along with his staff, and I would hope we would be seeing something forthcoming before a whole lot longer.
Thanks.
Okay, we have a last question in the queue right now from Bob Grant. So if anybody has any burning questions, please go ahead and get in the queue, and if not, we'll wrap this up shortly. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, Dr. Collins, I'd like to ask you two last questions, actually, one about the past and one about the future. The first is, I was wondering if you could give us just some insight into the types of conversations that you had with people at NIH, perhaps Dr. Zerhouni, about your departure and what kinds of advice you received concerning your future.
So that's an interesting question. Yes, when I first went to him with this decision about wanting to move into the white space of unemployment to try to see what might be out there waiting if I had a chance to explore it, he tried to talk me out of it, tried to convince me that it would be better to stay a while longer, you know, since science is going so well and I'm involved in an awful lot of projects, not just within this institute, but across the institutes. And I've certainly been a major participant in the planning for the NIH roadmap, which is Dr. Zerhouni's major contribution to the way in which we've done projects across institutes over the last 3 or 4 years. And it's been a really wonderful opportunity to tackle problems that no single institute could have undertaken. So yeah, he tried to talk me out of it, but as a gracious person, after he realized I was really serious about this, he set about to try to help make sure that we did this in a fashion that was going to have the least negative impact on the institute and on the NIH as a whole, and also in a way that would give me a chance to move into this new opportunity without too many bumps along the road over the next couple of months. So he's been wonderfully supportive and gracious, albeit I think he made it very clear this was not what he was hoping to hear from me right now.
Okay.
So there's both parts. There's a second part.
Yeah. So my next question is kind of, I'd just like to hear your personal opinion. I mean, we're getting a new administration this November. And obviously, the science policy environment is pretty charged right now. And I was just wondering, from your perspective, what do you sort of see on the future science policy landscape coming down the pike?
Well, I think it goes without saying that we have a great many challenges for our country, for our world, that need attention, and that many of them involve scientific interest and expertise being at the table. Certainly, when you look at the things that face us in terms of world hunger, in terms of poverty, in terms of global warming, in terms of energy stresses on where fuels are coming from, and in terms of health and disease in our own country and abroad, all of these are science issues. All of these issues, if they're going to be successfully negotiated over the coming years, I would hope there would be a strong, objective voice for science always in the table. In the room, at the table, contributing the information necessary to make wise decisions. So however this turns out in the midst of this, obviously, a very intense election year, I would hope that the future leader of this country would have a circumstance where science really had its opportunity to put forward whatever information is needed in order to make wise decisions. And I know I speak for many people in the scientific community who are hoping to see that kind of outcome after this election settles out.
Thank you very much, Dr. Collins, and best of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, and we have a question in the queue from Jocelyn Kaiser at Science Magazine. Jocelyn?
Hi, yeah, I have just one last question. I wondered if the position of NIH director becomes open in the next year or so, is that something that you would be interested in if you were offered the position?
Thanks, Jocelyn. Well, certainly NIH is, from my perspective, having been here for 15 years, the most wonderful government organization that I could possibly imagine. It's a real, as some have said, crown jewel of the federal government. It is the envy of the rest of the world in the way in which science is supported and conducted, both within our own walls and primarily by giving grants out to the best and brightest scientists across the country. And I have enormous respect for the institution. And again, without having really explored my alternatives in any meaningful way, yeah, I suppose if you ask me, is that something that I might have some interest in the future, in some possible configuration where NIH was well positioned to continue to make major strides? Yeah, I'd be crazy to say, oh, no, I don't think that's anything I'd want to talk about.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and that seems to be the last question in the queue, so unless anybody has any strong, burning, last-moment questions, we'll wrap this up, and I would like to thank everybody for participating, Dr. Collins and Dr. Guttmacher, and we'll look forward to continuing the conversation as time goes along. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks,
any last
everybody.
Words? You guys have any last words? Nope, they're shaking their heads no. All right, thank you very much.